So we're studying through John chapter 6. We're trying to look at a few things along the way that will help us to understand our Bible study a little more, help us to study a little better on our own, as well as being able to learn some things here together. And I hope we can do that again tonight. I had mentioned a couple of weeks ago that John only tells in detail of 7 of Jesus' miracles, and someone was commenting that I went through those too fast and they didn't get to mark them all. So if you didn't get a chance to do that, and if you want to just at the beginning of that chapter put, you know, M1 and M2, and that would be the easiest way maybe to mark that. But we'll mention those again, and I'll go a little more slowly, give you time to mark those if you're interested. The first one is in John chapter 2. Of course, we've looked at that one already. That's the changing of water to wine. And so in John chapter 2 is the first miracle of Jesus that's described in detail by John. Then the next one, the second one, is in John chapter 4. And that's toward the end of John chapter 4. He heals the officer's son, it's sometimes called. The man comes asking him to heal his son who is sick, and he does that. And that's in John chapter 4. Then in John chapter 5, and these are really back-to-back, and you know, we have to remember as we're going through our Bible readings that it wasn't broken up into chapters and verses when John wrote it. He just wrote one book, I guess we could call it, but when you really look at it, it's shorter than a lot of chapters in some of the novels that people read. It's 21 chapters the way we've got it broken up, but really it's only about 15 to 20 pages or so in it's a small print in that size, but it's not a lot of text there. And yet, you know, we think, oh, that's just so hard and so much to read. In actuality, if you're a fast reader, you could do it faster than this, but if you're just a slow reader, the reading out loud speed, like I would read verses from up here, you can read through the entire book of John in about an hour. And so you think about, we think about a book takes hours or days to get through the whole thing. And yet we call it the book of John sometimes, but it's not really that long. And of course these things weren't broken up into these chapters, so the healing of the officer's son that we have in chapter 4 was just back-to-back with the healing of the crippled man that we looked at a couple weeks back in John chapter 5. And so it was just told one story and then moved right on into the other events. And so we've covered all of those. Tonight we're going to be looking at John chapter 6, and there are two of his miracles in this one. Now the key here is, again, that one of these miracles was for the disciples only. It was only for the few. It wasn't for the whole crowd. Of course, the changing the water to wine, most of the people did not know about it. Only his mother and his disciples and those that were told to get the water pots, they're the only ones that really knew what he had done. Everybody else gave credit or blame to the master of the feast for the things that had happened. And so in John chapter 6, we're going to have the feeding of the 5,000. And this one, of course, is very significant in that of all of the miracles in the four different gospel accounts, the feeding of the 5,000 is the only thing, only miracle of this type that is recorded by all four of them. And so it gives us an opportunity to look across the four Gospels. You know, there are many things that Matthew and Mark both tell it, or Matthew and Luke both tell it, or Mark and Luke both tell it, and a few things that John and some of the others share. But this is the only miraculous thing, other than, of course, the resurrection itself, but this is the only miraculous thing that Jesus did that's actually recorded by each of the four Gospel writers. And so it does give us a chance to look at the different way that they tell that same story. You know, if any time two or three or more people go through an event, they're going to highlight different things about that event. And anytime you ask people about something, if I were to ask all the young people tonight about the movie that they went to saw, and for that matter the parents that went along with them, if I were to ask them about that movie, and I said, okay, well, you know, what do you remember from the movie? Different ones of them would remember different things, even though they all just saw it a couple of hours ago. But there are certain things that stick in our mind. The same thing would be true, you know, a sporting event. People will remember different plays and different things that happened. And part of that may be which team they were cheering for, you know, whether they remember the good things or the bad things. One of them may remember, boy, you know, the referees never seemed to throw a flag at all. And the other one says, referee was throwing a flag every time, every play. You know? Well, they can't both be telling the truth. Well, one of them, his team didn't get penalized, and the other guy's team did. And so it seemed that way to them, like it was almost every play. And they exaggerate, use some hyperbole there to explain the situation. But we're going to look at the feeding of the 5,000 and see some of that. Then after the feeding of the 5,000, a little further down into John 6, down around verse 16 is where it starts. We see the miracle of Jesus walking on the water, walking on the Sea of Galilee. And this too is just for his disciples. Nobody else saw this miracle performed. Now, they are very surprised when Jesus was here and then they look for him the next day and he's not there. And they know there weren't any other boats that left. And then they go find him and he's on the other side. And they're a little confused by that. Well, how did that happen? How did he get over here? We're looking for you. How did you get over here? So they are a little astonished by him being able to get across there without a boat. But they probably all feel, oh, well, he just snuck out and walked around. Or maybe there was a boat we didn't see. They, you know, they rationalized it away, as people will. So those are both in John chapter 6. We'll look at them a little bit tonight. And then the healing of the man that was born blind in John chapter 9. And we'll delve into that one when we get there. And then, of course, one of the biggest in some ways, and yet interestingly enough, the healing of the blind man, the man that was born blind in John 9, was actually a greater sign that Jesus was the Messiah than the one that we find in John chapter 11, which was his raising Lazarus from the dead. And the key to that, of course, is the fact that, and Jesus himself said, the blind, go tell John that the blind received their sight, when John was doubting whether he really was the Christ. He was in prison, he was fearing for his life, he wasn't sure what was going on, and sent his disciples to ask, and Jesus said, you go tell John what you've seen and heard, and you tell him. And one of the things that he told them to tell them was that the blind received their sight. Now, why is that significant? Well, that's significant because you had Naaman who had been cured of leprosy. You had Elisha had raised people from the dead. So the fact that Jesus raised somebody from the dead, really, even though that certainly we think, wow, what a miracle, that had been done before. Elisha had done that. Raised people from the dead. Well, yeah, it's been done before. But even the blind man himself, after he was healed, he said, it's never been heard that one born blind would be made able to see. That's never been heard of before. That was a miraculous thing that had never been done. And so, we can think about miraculous feeding. We can think about Elijah being fed by the ravens. By God. So there were miraculous things of these, not the same thing, but of amazing things had happened. You know, you had Elijah calling down fire on Mount Carmel and it came down and consumed the sacrifice and the water and the rocks and everything. You think about how hot that fire had to have been to consume those rocks. All of these miracles, but you know, the one of being somebody being born blind and being healed, that had never been done before. And so that one made that one very significant. So that was in John 9, and then the last one, of course, in John 11, the raising of Lazarus from the dead. All right, we definitely went through them slow enough that if you couldn't keep up and write down on that, you just didn't want to, because we went through those real slow. All right, let's look back to John chapter 6. And if you've got a little margin there, and if you want to mark it there, The parallels to this account are in Matthew chapter 14, verses 15 through 21. And Matthew's account is going to be a little different. And it's an interesting thing when we look at these accounts. The skeptics and the critics, whenever they try to attack the Bible, they attack it in two different ways when it comes to the Gospels. Because of the fact that the Gospels, all four, are telling the accounts of Jesus' life, they do one of two things. They say, well, those are so much alike, they must have copied each other, or they both copied from somebody else, and there's another, you know, so they're not, you know, they just copied it. That's the first argument, to try to discount the Bible. Or, in cases where they're different, so if they're the same, they say, well, that can't be inspired, they just copied it from somewhere, right? But if it's not the same, if there are differences there, then they look at that and they say, well, see, if it was inspired, it'd be the same. Well, you can't have it both ways. You can't say when it's the same, that's not inspired, and when it's not the same, that's not inspired. You can't argue both of those out of both sides of your mouth like that. And so when we look at these and we see the differences, and the other thing they point out is when they see something that's different, they say, oh, well, there's a contradiction. They contradict each other. Not every difference is a contradiction. And in fact, if you've ever heard things like that, heard, oh, the Bible's full of contradictions, things like that, if you've ever wondered about that, I would encourage you to get a couple of books, and hopefully they're going to come out with a third one soon, but a series written by Eric Lyons from Apologetics Press, and it's called The Anvil Rings. And he takes in those books and he deals with these passages where people say, well, this is a contradiction. And he answers how, that no, that's not a contradiction. You're just trying to put something there that's not. And you're making a misunderstanding there. So I'd encourage you to take a look at those books. It'll help clear some of those things up. Then we want to look also the other, in Mark chapter 6, verses 35 through 44. That one is the parallel that Mark tells the events of the feeding of the 5,000. So you can see those together. And then the Gospel of Luke also records it in Luke chapter 9, verses 12 through 17. And what you'll find as you read through those is that, you know, there are a lot of things are the same, a lot of the same facts are there, but then different ones give different details. I think perhaps, well, if we haven't looked at it, we'll look at it when we get there at the end of John, but another case where you can really look at and see the way that they call it sometimes the harmonization of the Gospels, where each one adds another thing to make the picture even more complete and more beautiful. And it's kind of like, you know, sometimes, especially Mark, because it's the shortest, will sometimes just give what looks like a pencil sketch outline. You know, he just gives the bare bones. And then Matthew will come in and shade in over here and shade in over there. And then Luke comes along and puts some color over here and some color over there to make the picture. And John comes and adds this and that. And finally you get the whole picture when you do it that way. And so we realize the importance of reading all that the Bible has to say about these things and how important it is. But we also see in these accounts, and I may bore Cameron because he brought me these books about, you know, studying about the textual differences. And I know Dwayne has talked about this a little bit when we talk about how we got our Bible. But we look at these things. This is one of those places where we see how some of the mistakes in the copies. You know, we don't have the original that John wrote. We have people made copies of it. And they didn't have a copy machine like we have where it ran off an exact duplicate of it. They had to do it by hand. And have you ever been trying to write something and copy it from something? Maybe you're copying down a phone number that somebody read to you, or you're copying down something else and you skip a number, or you add a, or you change a number. You know, especially you're trying to spell. So when I'm trying to tell people how to spell my name, and I say it's P P-A-S-L-E-Y. You'd be surprised how many times it comes back with a T at the beginning of it. People didn't hear P when I was spelling to them. They heard T. And so my name became Tastley sometimes. But that happens. We don't hear it quite right. We just don't copy it quite right. Dawn was copying a verse the other day and she duplicated something, or it was supposed to be he and she put the Lord or something like that in there when she was trying to copy it out, and she just copied it wrong. Well, sometimes we do that. And the people who were making copies of the Bible were human beings. And they were doing their best, but sometimes they did that same kind of thing. You ever be writing something and you put the twice? I know if you read the bulletins or you read the spiritual health regimens that I put there, you're going to find some mistakes like that. Even with my spell checker on my computer and the grammar checker on the computer, still sometimes things like that slip through where it gets messed up a little bit. Well, if we can do that even with all our technology to help us, you can imagine a fellow with just an inkwell and a feather tip pen, how much of a mistake he could make, how hard it would be to get it exactly right. And then you also realize sometimes the one they're copying from may have been damaged a little bit. And so it may be really hard to read. You ever try to copy something when it's really hard to read? But one of the things that happens, we talk about those things, but one of the things that happens is in similar accounts like this, people remember the way one of them read it. So for example, most of the time in the church, at least where I've been familiar with, and I'm based on a paper I've got downstairs, I think it's been the same here. Most of the time when people study about Christ and the life of Christ, they study the book of Matthew. So people are very familiar with the way Matthew tells the story and the wording that he uses. And on one occasion, we were studying the book of Mark instead of Matthew. And one of the ladies, I don't want to study. We've studied the book of Matthew. We've studied the life of Christ. We studied Matthew. We don't. It's the same thing. Well, when we got into it, she found, well, it's not the same. Mark tells things very differently than the way that Matthew does. And he includes some different things that Matthew didn't include in things. So it was a beneficial thing, but I know I've got a little card. I guess somebody had written out for one of the previous preachers that told what years which books had been studied. And I think Matthew was on there about three times. And I found John wasn't on there at all. Now, I don't know, maybe y'all have studied John and it just didn't get written on that card, or maybe you'd studied it since the time and that card wasn't real up to date. So maybe so. But it does seem to be that we study Matthew over and over again. But John kind of gets left out of the mix when John is very different. Very, very different. And we've seen that as we've been going through it. But one of the things that happens in those where people are used to the way Matthew says something, and when Mark or Luke or John tells the same story, but they tell it a little differently, people automatically remember the way Matthew said it. And so much so that sometimes if I were to read from you some of the parallel passages from Mark or Luke, and you were familiar with the way Matthew said it, when I read you the Mark or Luke passage, you'd say, that's not right. That's not the way that's said. You read that wrong. Now, you might not say that out loud, but that might be what you're thinking. Wait a minute, that's not the way I remember that. That wasn't like that. Well, the scribes did the same thing. And they would start a phrase, and they would think, oh, I know how this phrase ends, so they just write it on out. But that was not the way that phrase ended. Because maybe they were writing what Mark said, what Matthew said, but they were supposed to be copying Mark and writing what Mark said. And Mark didn't say it that way. And so they have copied a passage from Matthew and stuck it in the middle of their book of Mark that they're supposed to be copying. And those things are very apparent when they happen. And those that study the text see those things and go, somebody copied over here. They wrote the wrong thing here. because they've got 50 different copies or 150 different copies of it, and they've got, you know, 100 of them that are all the same, and then they got three or four over here that have this phrase from Matthew stuck in the middle of it. And well, those folks stole that phrase from Matthew and stuck it in there. And that's actually, there's a lot of what people call the mistakes, it's things like that that have happened. Or things where somebody's repeated a word or skipped a word, and it's really not a big deal. In fact, it's such a small deal that the idea is that less than one half of 1% of the so-called errors actually have any bearing on what we have in our English Bibles today. It's so rare that one of the, you know, because usually, you know, if you're reading along and you see in the bulletin, you're reading my bulletin article, and you see that I put the, do you say, oh, I don't know, I can't understand what this says now because it's got the here. I don't know what that is. Well, you just know. I put the twice, and so you just skip it and you go on. And that's the way a lot of the so-called mistakes, the things that the skeptics and the critics call mistakes, that's what they really are. They're not mistakes at all. All right, I'm going to get down off that soapbox. We spent most of our time there. So we'll run through just a few things. We just want to hit some highlights. Most of us are familiar with the story of the feeding of the 5,000, so I just wanted to hit a couple of highlights. And then next time, which will be not next week but the following week, because Cameron will be speaking next week with the youth devotional. But the following week, we'll get back to chapter 6 and look at some of the teaching that Jesus has down toward the end of the chapter. But Jesus is there at the Sea of Galilee, and John tells us that's also called the Sea of Tiberias. And there's a large crowd following him, and they had seen the signs that he was doing. They saw the miracles, so they start following him around. Now, whether they're following him around hoping that he'll do a miracle for them, or whether they're just following him around to get to see him do some other miracles, but they're fascinated by this. And we would be too, wouldn't we? If somebody could really do a miracle like that, it'd be an amazing thing. Jesus went up in the mountain and sat down with his disciples. Verse 4 tells us what time of year it was. It was the Passover, the Feast of the Jews. So we're talking early March, maybe into April, somewhere in there, because of when the Passover falls. It falls around March to April. So that's the time of year we're talking here. It says it was at hand. So it was early spring, and Jesus goes up, and he lifts up his eyes, and he sees the large crowd coming to him. And he's going to test one of his disciples. Now here, we want to understand the difference between a test and a temptation. There was no sin involved. And that's the way a test works. A test, there's not a sin. And now Philip, whether he passes this test or fails this test, he's going to test Philip by asking him a question. And whether Philip passes or fails the test, he's not committing sin. We understand the difference in that? When there's a temptation, if you don't succeed, then you've sinned. But with a test, it's just seeing how much you know. And that's what Jesus is doing. Let's see how much Philip knows here. So he turns to Philip and he says, where can we buy some bread so all these people can have something to eat? Now, I don't know how many big crowds you've ever been in. I think probably the biggest crowd I've ever been in was leaving Disney World one night. That's a big crowd. Now, I don't know how many people were in that crowd. I wouldn't even want to estimate. They say that about 150,000 people a day go into that park. I don't know how many of them were all trying to get out those gates when they were closing, but it was probably at least a third of them. It was a lot of folks. But imagine, here, there's 5,000 people coming. Now, he hadn't counted them all with this. He doesn't know. But he sees this crowd coming. And he looks up at that, and Jesus has just said, okay, Philip, where are we going to go buy some bread from? Now, remember, they weren't just down the street from Kroger. You know, they couldn't just, we'll just go over here to the grocery store and buy a bunch of bread. It wasn't like that. They would have had to have traveled into the town. Sometimes it's an hour or two's walk or even more to get to the town to get some food. And then that far back to bring it back. Not to mention, can you imagine carrying enough bread for 5,000 people? You'd need several wagons to load it up on. I mean, my family, there's only seven of us, and we go through a couple loaves of bread in a couple of days. So you can imagine a crowd of 5,000 people. And so he was testing Philip, but he already knew what he was going to do. And this is where we see the knowledge of Christ. He already knew what he was going to do. And Philip said, the Greek, 200 denarii. Now, a denarius, one denarius was a day's wage for a manual labor, for basically what would be a minimum wage type worker today. So if we figure $8 for a minimum wage worker, $7 to $8 somewhere in there, although it keeps rising. But if we figure, $65 a day, well, if you've got 200 times 65, that's quite a bit of money. In fact, this would be approximately like 8 months' wages. And Philip said, even if we had that much money, we wouldn't be able to buy enough bread to give everybody here something to eat. Now you think about how much it would cost if Cameron took all the young people and they went out to eat. And I imagine it was probably a pretty good sized bill. But can you imagine taking 5,000 people out and buying them food? And now we're not talking about just buying bags of flour and oil and making the bread yourself. We're not talking about that. If you go and buy it, it's going to cost you more than making it yourself. And so Philip, there's just no way we can't do this. But you've got to love Andrew. Andrew, whatever he's got, he brings it to Jesus and offers it. And here he comes. He said, "Hey, Jesus, here, I've got there's a boy here, he's got 5 barley loaves and 2 fish." But then, and he says that, and then he said, but what are they among so many? Well, that plus Jesus equals plenty. But they're still, they're still thinking in human terms. And we probably would be too. We had never seen somebody turn a little bit of food into enough to feed 5,000 people. But Jesus said, "Have them sit down." There was a lot of grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Now, a lot of people, when they look at these and look at the actual text of this, they think that it's likely. We're not certain. It doesn't say it so clearly that it's certain. But they think it's likely that there were no women and children involved. I know some of the accounts say 5,000 men besides women and children, but that word besides can also be translated separate from women and children. In other words, indicating that there weren't any women and children there. But there was this little boy with his lunch, so there was at least a few little boys anyway, maybe. But the idea being, this is a crowd of people that's coming to want to try to make Jesus their king. They've been looking for a Messiah, but the Messiah that the Jews were looking for was not the Messiah that was going to come save them from their sins. The Messiah that most of the Jews are looking for is the one who's going to come save them from the Roman occupation, that's going to reestablish Israel as a great kingdom on the earth, like in its heyday, back in the days of David and Solomon, when it was respected. And that's what they were looking for. A warrior king that was going to lead them in battle and reestablish their greatness and make them mighty again. They weren't looking for one that was going to come die for them. That's not at all what they were looking for. But here we have this group of people, a lot of them together, and they may be thinking that this is the guy. And there's actually in one account, not of this particular miracle necessarily, but in one account, there actually is a point where this crowd comes and tries to force him to be their king. And so this is the kind of thinking that's going on with these people. We think, oh, well, they're just amazed by the miracles, which they are. They're amazed by the teaching. Well, they are amazed by that too. But they're thinking, king. It's kind of like, hey, we're in the middle of a political season. You know, people are jumping behind one candidate or another going, this is the one we need to be the next president. Well, that's what these people were doing with Jesus. They're just, hey, we need to get him to be the next king. We need to get him to take over, and we'll overthrow these Romans and kick them out of here, and we'll take our country back. Wow, does that sound familiar? I think I've heard some statements like that from different groups in political circles here. We need to take our country back. Well, that's what they were thinking. They were thinking militaristically, and instead of thinking spiritually. And Jesus, of course, his kingdom wasn't of this world. It wasn't a physical kingdom. That was never the intention. But Jesus took the loaves. He gave the thanks. He started sharing it and passing it around. And with the fish as well, they ate as much as they wanted. That's very important, verse 11. They ate as much as they wanted. So this wasn't just a little... Now, you know, you could see somebody trying to prove they could do a miracle by redoing this, and they do it kind of like we take the Lord's Supper and just break off a little smidgen of cracker that basically when it comes out on your finger, it looks like a little bit crumb. You can't even taste it. It's so small. You know, some people... And now, if you did that, you had five big enough barley loaves, you could probably feed 5,000 people if they each just got a little crumb. That's not the point. Jesus fed them. They ate as much as they wanted. There was nobody there that wasn't stuffed like Thanksgiving dinner when this was over. Something interesting I found out about this, and I hadn't really thought about, but it's interesting that he didn't miraculously change this. You know, barley's not, you know, it's not fine flour. This isn't wheat, light white bread. You know, this is the thick, you know, this is the poor man's bread that they had back then. He didn't miraculously change it into steak or shrimp or, well, surely wouldn't have changed it into shrimp. That would have been unclean for the Jews. But, you know, he didn't change it into steak and a nice, cheddar cheese biscuit from Red Lobster, you know. He didn't change it like that, though. One of those lovely yeast rolls that they have. No, he didn't do that. It was still just barley bread and fish. It was still the same thing, but he just made sure everybody had enough to eat. Sometimes we expect Jesus to come along and change our lives so great and just give us everything and make everything. That's not what he did then. Why would we think he's going to do it that way now? He never promised that. Well, even after they were done, they filled up 12 baskets with the leftovers. I saw a cartoon or comic one time, the disciples picking up all those baskets, and they got these grumpy looks on their face, and Jesus said, "What's wrong?" They said, "We're going to have to eat leftovers for weeks." You know, but that's, you know, they got more at the end than they had at the beginning, and 5,000 people have eaten. And that's a miraculous thing. That's a miracle. And it's amazing. And the people were amazed. They recognized after this event, and they said in verse 14, "This is the prophet who is supposed to come into the world. This is him." Now, notice they've just said he's the prophet. Remember, Moses had said, "The Lord your God will raise up a prophet like me, and you need to listen to him." And he had said that. So they're looking for this prophet. But they haven't yet, and they say, okay, this is the prophet. He's doing miracles like Moses did, kind of miracles, amazing miracles. Feeding the 5,000. You know, we talk about the feeding of the 5,000. As I said, I really think John 9's miracle is greater in many ways as a sign that Jesus was the Messiah than any of these. How many people, now, and I know it wasn't Moses. It wasn't his power. He was using the power of God. How many people did Moses feed in the wilderness? 600,000 every day for 40 years. Well, he didn't do it. We know God did. But the same thing, you know, same thing here. It's God that's doing it. So 5,000 after God has fed 600,000 for 40 years with manna in the wilderness, feeding 5,000 with some bread and fish already, you already got something to work with. That's easy. That's a drop in the bucket. That's not even hard for the Lord. This was like, this is the easy day off. This is taking a break. Well, but here still, the people recognize this is the prophet. He's doing the kind of things Moses did. And Moses was a great prophet. And here he is doing these same kind of things. And we need to start paying attention to this guy. Now here it is in verse 15. Here's how worldly they're thinking. Jesus perceived. He understood what was in the hearts and minds of men. He knew they were about to come and take him by force to make him the king. He knew that's what they were about to do. And so he got away from them. And I don't know how he got away from a big, huge crowd of 5,000 people without somebody spotting him. But he withdrew into the mountains by himself. And in the evening, the disciples went down to the sea. And they got into the boat and they started across the sea. And it was dark. Jesus still hadn't come down to the boat when they left. The sea got rough, kind of stormy. They had rowed for 3 or 4 miles, and it was hard going, hard to do. They saw Jesus walking on the sea. Now, when it says they saw Jesus, they didn't, of course, realize who it was, or they wouldn't have been scared. But they were scared because they just saw, here comes, well, there's something. Y'all see that? There's something out there on the water. What is that? Is that just the waves? Are my eyes playing tricks? And as it got closer and closer, they said, that looks like a person. And so they start thinking, oh, it's a ghost. And we might pick on grown men for being scared in the dark, but how many of us have ever been a little unnerved by something? And yet, how many of us have ever seen something like what they're seeing? People just don't walk across the top of the water. That's just not normal. And to see that would be kind of a startling thing, to say the least. And so they were frightened when they saw him coming. But when he got close enough, he said to them, "It is I, don't be afraid." So he points out to them they don't need to be afraid of him. And then they took him in the boat. And I love verse 20. I love this. They took him into the boat. Now they'd been rowing 3 or 4 miles, they'd been rowing and rowing and rowing, and they couldn't, you know, they're not making any headway. It's the middle of the storm. You ever try to row a boat in a storm? I can't imagine. I have been in a canoe trying to paddle upstream. That's real hard. You can't paddle upstream in a canoe very well. They're trying to get where they want to go, and the storm is hindering them, and they can't get there. And the end of verse 21 says, after he got into the boat, immediately they were at the land. Just like that. You might could say that's the third miracle. Not only did he walk on the water, but when he got in the boat, they were miraculously right there at the land where they were supposed to be going. They'd been fighting all that through the night trying to get there. And suddenly, there they were. Now I'm going to just touch on this briefly and we'll look at it more next time. But Jesus begins to become a little put off by the people that start to crowd around him. And he makes the statement to them when they come up to him and oh, well, when did you get here? He says, you're not looking for me because of the miracles, because of the signs that you saw me do. You're just here because you got to eat the food. You ever known somebody like that? They just wanted what they could get out of it. As long as they got a full belly, they didn't care. That's these folks. And Jesus knows what they're thinking. They don't care about the miraculous things he's done. All they care about is he gave them a free lunch. Somebody said, Jesus really, you know, the people, the socialists would love Jesus. He gave them free health care and free food. You know, just what they wanted. Well, here he is. He's frustrated with them because what he And not that he didn't know it already, but what he is seeing in these people is that when you try to help them out, they just come to start expecting it from you. And sometimes we may be the same way. Think about the ways in your life that God has cared for you and provided for you. The blessings that He has given you. Have you come to the point where you just kind of expect it as though it's your right to have those things? Sometimes we're in danger of doing that. We're in danger of taking the grace of God, the love of God, the blessings of God, and we just take them for granted. He owes us. We deserve them. He's got to keep giving them to us. When we do that, we're as bad as these folks that he became frustrated with. Because we're only interested in, well, what can you do for me? Instead of being grateful to him because of what he's already done for us and being thankful to him. If you need to respond tonight for any reason, if you're not a Christian, to become one. If you are a Christian, but perhaps you haven't had the gratitude that you should toward the Lord, and you need to correct that in your life, or for any other reason, please respond as we stand and